A Theory of Infatuation, the 10th talk in a series titled Understanding Love, Sex, and Marriage, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 3, 2002, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay, tonight I want to deal with a theory of infatuation rather than a biblical theory of infatuation. And the reason I say that is because the Bible, as far as I know, as best I can tell, doesn't really have much to say about our topic tonight. So the source of my theory is not biblical teaching. The source of my theory is my experience, my observation, a whole lot of rock and roll, and various things like that. But I do think that what I have to say here is completely and perfectly compatible with what the Bible does have to say about various topics and is certainly not inconsistent with a biblical worldview. But I won't exalt it to the level of a biblical theory because I don't think the Bible has anything significant to say about it. Not that it doesn't, because I don't understand Song of Solomon, so there may be something there. But to start with, I just want to make an observation that is probably obvious and should be apparent, but I'm not sure we always think about it. I mean, we're so accustomed to it that we don't pause to think about how vague and ambiguous the term love is. I mean, it doesn't take much to see it. Any word that can be used as the verb in all these sentences obviously is a vague term. I love God. I love my enemy. I love ice cream. I love my old moccasins. I love my wife. I love my kids. Obviously, we're not talking about the same thing in each and every one of those sentences, and yet we use the same English word. And it's not just a phenomenon in English. It's a phenomenon in other languages as well, other languages that I know, anyway, that we don't have specific narrow terms to describe the different phenomena that each of those sentences describe. So we're stuck with having to use this vague, ambiguous term to describe a lot of different realities. So the term love, it seems to me, there's at least four different things that it describes in kind of broad strokes. On the one hand, the one that we're going to talk about tonight is that it does denote a certain emotional state or an emotional response. And it actually, again, is not very specific. It can describe a range of different emotional responses or emotional states, what we might call affection, delight, pleasure in relationship to another person or thing of one kind or another. And the thing I want to concentrate on tonight is what the Greeks called eros, and what I'm calling infatuation. I'll zero in on that tonight in my lecture. But it's all of these things belong to a category of our uses of the word love, where we're describing an emotional response or an emotional experience or an emotional state. I was just reminded, I know exactly what they feel like. I was in Tennessee with my brother for Thanksgiving, and there are umpteen million little infants around, all of his grandchildren, all of them ranging from about 6 months to 9 months old or something. And one of the parents was holding their little kid and just all of a sudden sort of kind of giggled and said, "I could just eat you." And we all know what that is like. I mean, it just communicates so well. You know, yeah, it's a good feeling, not a bad feeling. But that it's that bubbling up of emotion that we call love, an emotional response. Then there is an instinctual attachment. All of the various forms of familial love, for parent, for child, brother, for sister, in a larger family context, where you feel a kind of loyalty, you feel a kind of bond, you feel a kind of attachment, you honor that attachment, you acknowledge that attachment. Is it love? Yes, we use the word love to describe it. but it's its own kind of thing. There's something else going on there than is going on in other interpersonal relationships that we call love. So we use it to describe an instinctual attachment. We use it to describe certain intellectual appreciations of things. Love and respect are closely allied with each other. When I say sometimes that I really love something, or we might use the word like, but we mean we respect what it is. We appreciate it. We acknowledge it. We have praise for it. And we can use love in certain contexts to describe that. But fourthly, love can be used to describe a moral commitment of a person to other people or things. When we love God, what do we mean by that? That gets confusing to people, the vagueness of the term. Because many people in Christian culture think that what that means is to love God is to have affection for God. The problem with having affection for God is that God is not the sort of thing that you can have affection, the sort of being that you can have affection for, because we experience him as rather remote and abstract and absent from us. He's the transcendent creator, the author behind it all. And because he's everywhere, he's nowhere. And since he is nowhere, it's hard to have affection towards something that lacking in concreteness and tangibility. So the only way to have affection for God is to turn God into my imaginary best friend, my imaginary friend, and have affection for God who I have shrunk down to size, a God who I have made in my image, or at least the image of a friend of mine, and we can have affection toward that God. But that God, of course, is different from the transcendent creator God of the universe. So when the Bible is talking about loving God, it doesn't really mean affection, I don't believe. What the Bible means by loving God is a moral commitment. To love God is to have made a moral commitment to the purposes, the promises, the values, and the being who is the transcendent author of all reality, and to make a commitment to all that he is and all that he stands for. To seek to emulate his value system, to honor his value system, to practice his value system, and so on. That's what it means to love God, not to have affection for him. As we have seen in this course this quarter, I hope, to love my spouse in a marriage relationship is fundamentally and primarily a moral commitment. Is there affection? Well, there is also that. That's there as well. Is there the kind of delight and the kind of pleasure in the relationship that involves an emotional response? Yeah, there is that as well. But the engine that really drives a marriage relationship, the love that really drives the marriage relationship, is this actual moral commitment to the person for the sake of the commitment itself, the moral commitment itself. And there are other interpersonal relationships where to say that I love them means I'm committed to their well-being. I'm committed to serving them. I'm committed to bringing good into their life. That's what it means to love them. So that's why we can have a commandment in the scripture to love our enemies. Those who have nothing but animosity for us and wish us harm, we can nonetheless will their good and work toward their good, make choices that would promote their well-being and their good. It doesn't mean we have affection for them. It doesn't mean we like them. That's a whole different meaning to the word love that has nothing to do with the commandment to love them. The commandment to love them is a different reality. It's a moral commitment to do good to those who do you harm or wish you harm. So, all that, well, what comes out of that, of course, are a whole slew of problems, and I won't get into all of them, but take a statement where it's commonplace for us to recognize that our marriages need to be based on love, that love is the foundation of the marriage relationship. Well, in one sense, that's true. In one sense of the word love, that's true. In other senses of the word love, that's false. That's a completely false statement. If what I mean by love is the moral commitment that I just described a second ago, then that's true. Yes. The foundation and the basis for a marriage is love, a moral commitment to do right by one another, to be good to one another, to respect one another, to become one with one another, and all that we have described marriage to be. To make that commitment is the foundation of a marriage relationship. But if we're talking about an emotional state, that's false. That's not the foundation of marriage. There doesn't have to be affection in order for there to be a marriage relationship that's solid and healthy and sound. There doesn't have to be eros, as and I will define that in a second, in order for you to have a healthy and sound and solid marriage. It doesn't have to be there, because that's not fundamentally what it's all about. It may or may not be there. It will and will not be there. It'll be there in one day and not there the next. There are times in my relationship where I just flat out haven't liked Jody, but I was committed to her, and that it was that commitment that saw me through to forgiving what I needed to forgive, to be patient with what I needed to be patient with, to serve even when I didn't feel like serving. It's this other commitment that is the engine that drives the relationship. The emotions are going to come and go, are going to wax and wane. Sometimes I feel like I would like to eat her. but that when that giggly little excitement of affection bubbles up. But it doesn't have to be there in order for the relationship to go, in order for the relationship to have substance and reality and to be real and to be authentic. It's a great scene, if you've seen Fiddler on the Roof, the musical Fiddler on the Roof, where they're facing for the first time this modern notion that you would have a relationship between a man and woman based solely and purely on eros, and their youngest daughter, I guess it is, who's fallen in love with this Marxist Bolshevik Russian, is wanting to be married to him, and this new idea has crossed the mind of the father, and he starts asking the question, do I love my wife? And then there's that song, do you love me, do you love me? I won't sing it. and they recite all the experiences they've had together, all the drudgery, the mundane, average, ordinary spending time, logging time, caring for one another, going through the thick and thin of life together with one another. And I think the force of the song is to say, if that's not love, I don't know what is. I think it is. There's something very profoundly true about that. What makes the marriage relationship the marriage relationship is this commitment to two people to one another, not this feeling of eros toward one another. So, all this is to say, we need to become philosophers at least in one area of our lives. If we reject and forsake philosophy in every area of our life, we need to become philosophers with respect to the one area of the meaning of the word love. We need to be sophisticated and subtle in our thinking about that. It doesn't mean the same thing in every context, and we need to learn the different meanings of the word and not confuse them one with another. So, with all that said, I want to concentrate on one very narrow sense of the word. And I've described it, I've identified it with the Greek word eros. Now, don't be confused by that. We, of course, get the word erotic from the word eros. But what we mean by erotic and what the Greeks meant by eros are radically different from one another. Eros was what we think of as Platonic love, that noble kind of bonding of two souls with one another that transcends any bodily attraction, any physical attraction. It doesn't involve that. It involves the melding of two people at a soulish level, at the level of their mind, their psyches, or something like that. That's what Plato meant by eros. We call it love today. We call it falling in love or being in love, where you feel a certain way toward a person. It's not really animalistic. It's not physical. It's not sexual in that sense, in the sense of our modern word, erotic. It's it's one being bonded to another being, at least feeling like they are bonded to another being. Now, I'm going to call it infatuation because I think infatuation is what we're talking about here. What's confusing about that is that we tend to reserve the word infatuation for its infantile adolescent form. That silly, childish little puppy love. We call that infatuation. When adults have the same feeling, we call it love. Now, there is a difference because adults are more sophisticated. Adults are experienced. Adults are not childish in the way they handle it. And so there seems to be a phenomenal or an empirical reason to say, well, that's different. They're a different phenomenon because they do act differently up to a point. I mean, to a degree, they act differently. But my contention is they're really basically the same thing. It's just a question of one is being encountered by an adolescent or a child, and the other is being encountered by an adult. But the phenomenon is fundamentally the same, I would argue, and that's why I use the same word to describe it, infatuation. Or we use the word being in love, falling in love with somebody. Eros, let me describe it, let me define it. Eros is the very noble feeling, and I stress the word noble. It's a very clean, noble feeling because it feels so other-centered. It feels the opposite of being selfish. It's all about the other person. It's a very noble feeling that makes me feel like I want nothing else except for him or her to be happy. I know in the throes of love, one of the things that you feel like is, I mean, on the one hand, the feeling of love, as I will go on to explain what I think its purpose is to bond me to the other person in a way that makes marriage interesting to me, desirable, attractive, compelling to me. So I want to be married to the person that I'm in love with, on the one hand. On the other hand, when you're in the throes of love, there's such a nobility to that feeling that you will often articulate to yourself, even if they end up going and marrying someone else, that's okay with me, martyr that I am. That's okay with me. I just want them to be happy. And that's a very real feeling. I mean, that is how it feels. That is a genuine, authentic expression of how we feel. It's a feeling that makes me feel like I would do absolutely anything for the other person, even to the point of dying for the other person. That's how much I feel like I want their good for them. It makes me feel like I want nothing but happiness for the other person, as I've just described. It makes me feel like I want to serve the other person for all time. I want to spend the rest of my life serving them. It's a feeling that I have that makes me want to share all that I have and all that I am with the other person. It makes me feel like I need the other person. In modern times, I think the place where I have seen love captured the best was in, there's an old album cut by Peter Paul and Mary. There's a live concert. It's called Peter Paul and Mary in Concert. And Paul Stuckey does a, they sing, I've got a dog and his name is Blue. Bet you $5 he's a good dog too. I mean, that it's an old folk song, and they sing it, and then they say, what if some unscrupulous modifier of folk songs were to take hold of this song and turn it into, gasp, a rock and roll song? And then they sing a rock and roll version of it. Any of you heard it? No? Well, I'm old. But he turns it into a rock and roll song. And at some point, it's the old 50s rock and roll where at some point you break into this, as before rap, you break into this simply narration. And in this narration, he says, this is a love song sung to his dog. But he says at one point, I want you, I need you, and I'm going to have you. But the point he makes before the song is that this takes all of the elements of every rock and roll song he's ever heard. And it's really true. I mean, how often do you, in the old 50s rock and roll, I want you, I need you, and that kind of language? Well, why? because it's reflecting a part of our experience. It's really true. We feel like we need the other person. I need to serve him or her. I need to make him or her happy in order to be happy myself. I can't be happy until they are happy. It's how it feels. It's this very noble feeling that makes me feel like I want nothing more than to be in his or her presence and gaze upon him or her. And the feeling that that to be parted from him or her is torture. A hurt, an ache, a longing when I'm apart from the other person. And in addition to all of that feeling, it's also a feeling about a feeling. It also involves the feeling that I could never possibly feel any other way about that person. It's a feeling that above all feelings is everlasting. It will never die. How often have you heard that in rock and roll songs? So we've come to label this in our vernacular true love, or as one famous movie character said, true love. Because true love, it never dies. And so we have this mythology that we have invented that you can be infatuated with person A, and lo and behold, it fades away. And then we're infatuated with person B, and lo and behold, it fades away. And we get infatuated with person C, and behold, it fades away. But now I'm in love with person D, and this is true love. And how do I know that it's true love? Because it will never die. How do you know it will never die? It feels like it will never die. Never mind that it felt that way with A, B, and C as well. But this time, this is true love. This one will never go away. And so, again, in our mythology, we make a distinction between true love and infatuation, because infatuation is somehow not real. Infatuation will eventually fade away. True love, according to our mythology, will never fade away. It will be this intense, compelling emotion that makes me ache for the other person, that will always make me ache for the other person. It will never be other than that, because this is true love, and true love lasts forever. True love is eternal. True love is everlasting. I think you know what I'm talking about. I think you know the picture. My contention, my theory, is that eros, or infatuation, is a God-given, totally and completely 100% organic drug which creates in me a kind of raises my consciousness, alters my consciousness, creates in me a vision, a sort of real and true dream of the joy of marital commitment in order to open me up to the possibility of marriage and up to the possibility of making the commitment. Now, this is going to sound far more cynical than I actually mean it, but remember the encounter with Jesus and the disciples where Jesus was talking about divorce and the perspective on divorce, that God intended people never to separate. People that have been joined should never be brought asunder. God, from the intention, did not have in mind people who are married to one another ever breaking up. That was not so from the beginning, but because of your hardness of heart, Moses instructed you to give her a certificate of divorce. And the disciples, remember their response? If this is so, then it would be better not to be married. And Jesus doesn't really buy that exactly. But that response is the response of all of us in our sanity. So God has given us a drug to make us insane enough to get married. To alter our consciousness, to mess with our vision, to play with our vision of things, to actually make what is in reality difficult, and what is reality hard, and what is in reality taking on a life of certain grief and pain and disappointment and failure. I mean, we all know that that's true. Who would take that on willingly if we didn't also have a compelling reason to take it on? And one of those little boosts to our, one of those incentives that God has given us is this thing called eros, this thing called love. unlike other drugs, this God-given organic drug gives me a true vision, not a false vision. I mean, the thing is, all that love, all that Eros makes me feel should be, can be, and will be a reality that two people create for themselves out of this moral commitment to one another. It will be forever. It will be a kind of oneness that love feels. It will be a kind of total and complete sharing with one another that love feels. It will be a desiring the good for one another that love makes me feel. I mean, we could go right down the line and look at what this feeling is, and it's what people who get married are committing themselves to creating. Yes, we are committing ourselves to be there for one another in order to create this kind of relationship. Now, the difference, of course, is when you're in the throes of Eros, it is all so easy. It is all so easy to be selfless when you feel like being selfless. But in the realities of the marriage relationship, you also need to be selfless when you no longer feel like being selfless. But why do you do it? Because you committed yourself to it. Because before God, you took an oath that that's what you would do. I think God's intention was for Eros always to fade, always to evaporate, always to disappear, because that's not intended to be the engine that drives the marriage. It's the commitment that's the engine that drives the marriage, and the commitment is supposed to take over when the Eros is evaporated. But of course, we don't like it that way, so Walt Disney comes along and says, right at the point when they're at the height of their erotic, in this sense, romantic love for one another, we stop the film and just say they lived happily ever after. And that has fed our imaginations, that's fed the mythology of our culture, that we love that story. We love that myth. That true love, is going to, once you've found that person that you can have true love with, that it is nothing but bliss and happiness and ecstasy and joy and delight forever and ever and ever. Amen. But it's a myth. God never intended that. He didn't create us that way. We couldn't sustain that feeling even if we tried. Now, we can prolong it by feeding it, especially with our imagination and with this mythology and with the fictions, with the stories we tell ourselves. We can prolong it to a certain extent, but it's not in of itself something that can endure. It's not made to endure. But as you all know, it is a very, very compelling feeling. And our culture, many people in our culture get addicted to it. There are some people who would rather be in love than be married. And so they go from one infatuation to the next infatuation, and then when that fades, they go get somebody else that they can be infatuated with, and then they go get somebody else that they can be infatuated with, and go get somebody else that they can be infatuated with. One of the characteristics of Eros is familiarity kills it. The more familiar somebody else, the less mysterious they are, the less soil there is for the seeds of infatuation to grow in. That's why it dies within a marriage, because my marriage partner becomes also ordinary and familiar to me. And I can't be erotically attached to someone who is that known to me, who's that transparent to me. By its very nature, it's only a feeling. It's important to recognize that. There's no substance to it. It's like a bubble. You know, there is no reality or any substance to it. Being in love with someone doesn't establish a relationship with them. It's the moral commitment that would take over, that would give substance to the relationship. It's the difference between feeling like serving somebody and actually serving them. You know, when I actually serve them, now the relationship is beginning to take on substance. But if I stop serving them the minute the feeling goes away, then there wasn't much to the relationship, was there? And yet, there's so many people in our cultures, and you see it in the Hollywood culture like crazy. I mean, why can Hollywood stars not stay married to one another? Because they are the priests and priestesses of this mythology of love. And they're trying to live out this relationship of man to woman in love with one another. And lo and behold, the love disappears and they stop being good to one another and stop respecting one another. There's no moral commitment to take over. Okay. So what are the ethics then of infatuation? Well, as I've already implied, I think it's wrong to base a marriage on eros or on infatuation, because it can't last. By the very nature of what love, infatuation is, it won't be there in time. That creates not only a problem for the marriages that they can't last, but it creates a whole culture that is a problematic culture. In our romantic, in-love, eros culture, marriages and families are on a very, very fragile foundation. And I think we've discovered that in recent years. Just the frequency of divorce and adultery and immorality and so on are all fueled by this having established our marriages on the wrong foundation to start with. I personally think it's wrong to try to prolong eros in marriage. I know you can go to your Christian bookstore and find books telling you, 55 ways to prolong love in your marriage. They call it love, which, of course, you need to prolong love in your marriage if we use the right definition of love. But we all know what they mean. What they mean is eros. And here's the ways that you prolong eros in your marriage. Women, get dressed up in nothing but cellophane and meet your husband at the door and all kinds of things like that. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood here. Is there an emotional component to the love that a husband has for a wife? Absolutely. I have a tremendous amount of affection for my wife. She is very dear to me. She's very precious to me. I treasure her. She's the most important gift that God has given me. Am I infatuated with her? No. Now, I know that's heresy to the mythology of our culture. But, and would I love to be infatuated with my wife? Well, sure. I mean, why not? It's a great feeling. It's the greatest feeling on the planet. It's probably better than heroin. I haven't tried heroin, but it's probably better than heroin. I mean, it's a really, really fantastic emotion. So of course I would love to have it, but it's not meant to be. It's not meant to be the staple of our lives and of our marriage relationship. But you can't have a healthy relationship between husband and wife without there being an emotional component to it, where you can delight in the other person, you respect one another, you like one another, but it's different. Because you like someone that you know, not someone who's mysterious to you, not someone that you're at least halfway inventing in your own imagination. You love a real person that you really know, with all of their weaknesses, all of their failures, all of their shortcomings, all their inadequacies. You know them. But you respect them anyway. And you've been through a lot together, and you're friends. You're bonded for life by life and life experience itself. So I'm not for a second denying that there is an emotional component to the love that operates in marriage, but it's not eros. Eros is a different kind of emotional response. I think it's wrong to base a decision as to who to marry on the basis of eros alone. Now, I've argued that I think part of the purpose of eros or infatuation is to get us interested. It's a compelling feeling, a vision of what marriage could be, that is attractive to us, that makes us interested in making the commitment of marriage. So eros is certainly going to be a component. And I frankly don't agree with people who say we should go back to just plain old anonymous arranged marriages where love has nothing to do with it. I think one of the few things that we've done right in modern times is to make eros one part of the equation. To make to marry people that we have decided voluntarily we are interested in marrying. I think that's a good thing, not a bad thing. But we've gone too far the other direction, and that is to make the feeling of love and that alone to be the basis of our decision. But that credits Eros with having more substance than it has. It's just a feeling. And the feeling might make me interested in asking the question, do I want to marry that person? But it shouldn't answer the question. It should only make me interested in asking the question. I need to answer that question with wisdom. Are they godly or are they ungodly? Are their values compatible with the values that are the most important values of my life? Are they going in the same direction spiritually? Do we want to love God? I mean, does that person want to love God? Is that person going to help me love God and encourage me to love God? Or is that person going to distract me from those things? I mean, those become vital questions in the decision of who I should marry them. It's wrong to use Eros as a justification for sexual intimacy. For decades now, in our culture, if you love someone, then sex seems appropriate. You know, what we as culture, what our culture has rejected is just sex for sex sake. You know, to have sex with someone but not really love them, I mean, that was immoral. But of course, if you loved each other, then sexual intimacy was okay. And what did they mean by love each other? Infatuated with one another. Be under the throes of Eros. Somehow Eros justifies the sexual intimacy. Well, it doesn't. The thing that justifies sexual intimacy is the marriage commitment, not Eros. Because then there's a substantive reality that sexual intimacy is expressing and ratifying and celebrating. But Eros is just a bubble that can be gone tomorrow. And to use that as the justification for something as meaningful as sexual intimacy is just wrong. It's wrong to pursue Eros-based relationships with the others, with a member of the other sex, in any context. It's just as wrong to lust after Eros as it is to lust after sex itself, physical sex itself. And by and large, I've come in on this in conversations after class, but I don't think I've ever mentioned this in a lecture. It seems to me that male sexuality, and I mean here now the male perspective on physical sexual intimacy, is for the most part very different than the perspective that a female has on physical sexual intimacy. We look at it differently. It means different things to us. And there's a lot of confusion between the sexes over that issue. So there's as a tendency, as a general rule, men are going to have more of a problem with lusting after physical sex, after physical pleasure in its own sake. Women, I think, are going to have more of a temptation to lust after love, to lust after Eros. Eros is their drug of choice. Orgasm is a man's drug of choice. And that there's significantly different level of interest between the sexes, I think, from my experience. But they're both wrong. They're both equally a distortion of what sexuality is and what God intended it to be and how he intended it to operate. But partly commonsensically, but partly because of the mythology of our age, it seems more noble to have an addiction to Eros than it does to have an addiction to physical sex, love versus sex. Being addicted with love seems innocent. I mean, it seems pure. It seems noble. Addicted to sex seems dirty and animalistic and bestial and so on. Well, actually, they're both perverse, and we need to recognize that and recognize perversion when we see it. So when we enjoy romantic movies and books and novels uncritically, just as when we enjoy, and I'm using erotic in the modern sense now, erotic scenes in movies or books uncritically, they are equally wrong. I read an article, it was a secular magazine, I don't remember which one it was, but where this woman was describing her discovery of the possibility of having an emotional affair. She realized that she was more attached to somebody that she was working with in the office than she was even her own husband, and that her emotional commitments had become removed from her husband and onto this other man. And I think that was very profound insight. I mean, I think that's really true, that it's very possible to have an extramarital affair that does not involve physical sexuality at all, where all we are doing is enjoying eros together rather than sexual intimacy together. But I think that's an abuse just the same. I don't know if I'd go so far as to call it, well, I don't know. It's adultery more by a kind of analogy and metaphor than it is in fact, I think, but it's still an abuse of what God created. Well, if marriage is not based on eros and infatuation and love, romantic love in that sense, then what is it based on? Bottom line, of course, is commitment. And in the final analysis, that's all we really need to make a marriage, is just the commitment before God to be the right kind of man to that woman and the right kind of woman to that man. That may be harder than other marriages, because if you don't like the person, it makes it that much harder. But that's all that's really required. But ideally, it seems to me, we wouldn't willingly get ourselves into that kind of relationship where all we have going is the commitment that I've made to them, the promises that I've made. We would also have, at a minimum, respect for the other person and ideally friendship with the other person. We should marry our friend, I think. And at least in that regard, I think we in modern times have a better perspective than throughout history when they've just taken some woman in a neighboring village and said, "Here, son, she's yours." That doesn't make any sense to me. Okay. I think that's enough for now. I'll take your questions. Some more of the implications of this we'll talk about next quarter, when we talk about dating and how you deal with infatuation and what implications that has for finding one another and deciding to get married and so on. And we'll deal with those topics next quarter.
I just wanted to add that I was hearing you say that it's just a feeling. I want to maybe expand that a little bit and say it's not the substance, which is where I think you're going with that, it doesn't say something true about this relationship necessarily. But I think as a feeling, it really gives us some good information.
It's a meaningful feeling.
And even if it's an inappropriate feeling for someone that I don't have a right to or ought not to be going toward, it's a feeling that gives me information about what I might be longing for or desiring, and it raises questions for me. So I think that that's what our feelings do for us in general. I mean, when we have, that's kind of how we come equipped with emotions, that they give us information in that sense.
Okay. The only qualification I'd put on that, or the only hesitancy I would have about that, is, you know, some of the other feelings that we have are arising out of something within us. But even in the ancient mythology, you know, the mythology was that Cupid shoots his arrow at you and bing, you fall in love. There's something about this. Met this woman who just for some reason, Cupid's arrow, just found myself utterly intrigued by that person. Fortunately, I had taught this class before. And so I was, in a sense, prepared for it. If I had not been prepared for it, and I think this happens to a lot of people, it just blindsides them, because all of a sudden there's this feeling here, and it's compelling, and it's powerful, and it's a dynamic feeling. And then fed by the mythology of our age, you can get the impression, oh my God, I married the wrong person. And then we begin to think in terms of, wow, if I'm in love with this person, maybe that's the person that God wanted me to marry. And people there's no end to the lengths that they will go to rationalize the decisions they make from there. I think a lot of adultery stems from that. A lot of divorce stems from that, from just being blindsided by this feeling. And I think there's a mysterious component to it that, I mean, maybe there's information there, but I don't know how accessible that information is always, because it's so...
I guess what I've... Because I agree 100% with what you're saying, and I think it's really important to make a really big distinction between a feeling that I think this is true for most of our feelings. Whether or not we act on them is a whole different question,
right.
A whole different set of questions. But the information that it could be telling me is that... that I'm vulnerable for some reason, or that I need to be especially careful to not commit something to this person that I ought not to be committing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that kind of thing. It can give me information about how to care about that person more, better, because I'm aware of this vulnerability I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to really be cautious about how I treat their heart and mine. So it's that kind of information that I'm talking about, that... I'm not saying I'm necessarily going to understand its origin, or, but I think it can have value in kind of evaluating it and using that information.
Right.
Does that make sense?
I think so. I think I follow what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, it put me on guard. I need to be really careful here, because if I feed this, it's going to lead me to make some really stupid choices.
Exactly. Yeah.
Maybe you're going to deal with this next term, in which case I can just wait. But if we're talking about a drug, what, in your experience, is the best antidote for one-sided infatuation? I'm not talking about, like, just inappropriate, like it shouldn't be. Like, if you've realized that you have this feeling, but it's obviously one-sided, like, how do you deal with that aside from just avoiding that person completely?
Well, the traditional antidote is whiskey. Okay, let's see. The best antidote is, time, but is my own wisdom, my own understanding that, yes, I feel this way, but there is no reality to the feeling. There's no substance to it at this point. What we're going to be tempted to do when we feel that way is to do whatever we can to manipulate the other person into feeling likewise. I mean, that's the tremendous temptation. And it seems to me very, very important that we resist that temptation. I mean, the thing, in all the instances of unrequited love, and all my love was always unrequited for some strange reason. I mean, it's hell. It's the most hellish experience on earth, because you are in pain, in anguish, with longing for the other person, and they don't seem to know. No, they don't seem to care. But one of the things that was very important to me that helped sustain me is a recognition that if God wants me together with another person in marriage for the rest of my life, nothing's going to stop it. Their not being interested is not an obstacle to us being... It's not an obstacle to us being together if God has destined us to be together. And so I could relax with that. I mean, because what it feels like is, I have found the truth here. We were meant for each other. Why don't they see it? You know? And it was some of the most important lessons in faith for me came out of unrequited love. They're having to deal with, what do I do with such a compelling feeling, and yet no way to act on it. No way to act on it righteously. And I had to figure out what faith was. What does it mean to trust God? Do I really believe He's in control of reality? Can I really trust Him to get done what needs to get done, to get done what I want done? Very important part of my life, I think. But it was hell. I hated it.
Also, we remember the song, so we'll sing it for you after.
Okay. I'm not, like I said, I don't know what the Song of Solomon means, but there is one line that's a refrain that keeps coming up. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. Maybe there's another part of the line, but I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases. I think that means something. I would like to think that what it means is don't feed romantic desire. Let it reach its fruition in a commitment. Don't do anything to stoke it. Just let it run its course. It will either die, it will either fade, it will either evaporate, or it will translate into a marriage commitment. But let it do its thing. Don't seek it. Don't seek to nurture it and fortify it, because you'll only end up making mistakes if you do that. If that's what that means, in any case, even if it's not what it means, I think that's wisdom. And that's what I kept telling myself during that time. So it's an antidote in the sense that it keeps me on the right track, but it's not an antidote in the sense that it makes it go away. I think only time will let it just evaporate of its own accord.
So just to follow up on that, our question back here, of course, is who are Peter, Paul, and Mary? We really don't know. But that idea I found intriguing that you just said just in your last comment was to let that feeling evaporate. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Those that are, you know, when you're in this throw of infatuation and love or whatever else, our culture tells us, as I think you might say, to feed it and give it life and create a true addiction out of it. But I think you have an interesting antidote there to maybe sit with it. Is that what you're suggesting? And open that up to others in the room? Or do you...
What yeah, happens? Let it die of inattention. If it's going to die, let it die of inattention. But you can see why we don't want it to die. Because it feels so good. Why would I want it to go away? Except that it feels so bad when it's unrequited. Because it feels so good, we don't want it to die. And so there's a tremendous temptation to keep it alive. But we need to just simply decide, but if it's not going anywhere, if it's not leading to anything, if there's not going to be any reality that this transforms itself into, then it needs to die. And so I need to give it the freedom to just go away. My first love was through a young woman that I met when I was in college and barely had any time together, but we spent the summer corresponding with each other. And boy, was I in love. And finally, at the end of the summer, I went back to school and we met up again, and some alien had taken over her body. I mean, it wasn't the same person. I mean, when it finally came to interacting, not with the person of my imagination, not the person that I had made her out to be, but the person that she really was, the feeling just evaporated. Now, that was rather quickly. Sometimes feelings die, linger much longer than that. But in time, as reality encroaches, eros, infatuation, will go away one way or the other.
You seem to also be...
Who's talking? Okay. Scared me. For a second there, I thought it was God.
You're not encouraging this even within a relationship of marriage, a committed
right.
relationship of marriage. You're not encouraging any sort of eros and you don't feel that the couples should pursue this in any way towards each other.
Right. Do I think it's wrong? I guess I don't think it's wrong so much as I think it's unrealistic. I think the same things that would create and foster eros in a dating relationship, in a relationship before marriage, are more likely just to be symbols of endearment and respect and so on within marriage. And that's fine. I mean, would that I did more of that. that would be a good and right thing to do, an appropriate thing to do. But I think it's unrealistic to think that it's going to create the same phenomenon and the same experience that we can have outside of marriage. I just don't think it'll do it. Now, remember, this is not a biblical theory. And it may very well be that this is just my own experience speaking, and I may just be weird. I mean, maybe it's more available and accessible to people than I realize and can realize from my experience. So I think that's something that people have to answer for themselves. But I know in my case, it would be unrealistic, I think.
In what way would it be unrealistic? And do you see a difference in encouraging eros within a marriage? I mean, what is the difference between encouraging it in a relationship that's of a couple that's married and in a couple that's not married yet?
Well, okay, let's take within marriage. The problem I can see with going for it within marriage is I have to ask myself the question, why? I mean, what is it that I'm going for? What am I doing? Is this a replacement for the everyday, ordinary, mundane commitment to just serve one another for the sake of serving one another, whether I feel like it or not? Is it the only way I can get myself to serve? Is if I can get myself to feel in love in order to serve? I mean, if that's what's going on, then I see a problem with that. Otherwise, if it's just a certain emotional pleasure that I want to steal within the context of our overall relationship with each other, I don't have a problem with that, sure. As long as it's not replacing what is the real engine that drives the relationship, then I don't have a problem with it. At least it's not obvious to me that I can see any basis for having a problem with it. Whereas, outside of marriage, we're either doing one of... I mean, outside of marriage, it just seems to me that we're going for the drug. I mean, that's what we want. Why do I see it unrealistic?
One of the things that I've wrestled with in my own marriage is the drop-off of the infatuation and the reasons for it. And you seem to indicate that it was really part of God's design, that the infatuation is there as a drug to open me up to the possibility of marriage. Then I get married, and then the drug eventually wears off. And one of the things I guess I've comforted myself with, and maybe I'm wrong, is that one of the main reasons why the drug wears off is really because I'm a sinner. And it's my selfishness that needs that to remain in order for me to just, quite frankly, feel good about myself. So that in a perfect world, it might actually remain. But what I would do is I would use the infatuation wisely, morally. The problem is I'm not perfect. I'm a sinner. I don't live in a perfect world. I live in a sinful world. And so it's my sin that really kills it, in addition to the fact maybe that if it were to remain, my sin also would continue to would cause me to actually use it unwisely, because it has done that a lot even in my marital relationship, and certainly in previous relationships too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good question. No, I'm looking at it differently. Yeah, I'm looking at it as it not being a result of sin killing it, but as it being in the very nature of love and infatuation itself that it cannot and will not and does not and need not endure. That's how I'm looking at it. Now, I may be wrong, but fundamental to my theory here is that even in a completely unfallen, perfect, sinless world, it would have a role to play, but its role would be to simply make interesting the possibilities of this relationship, and then the relationship takes over. And that within the relationship is a more mundane, ordinary...
Just this whole thing, I've been struggling with something having to do with this, and something that's come to my mind in the New Testament kind of seems to support this in the passages about marriage, and you know how it says it's good enough for a man to touch a woman and all that kind of thing, and you know because of sin that it's better to marry than to burn and all that stuff. And I've noticed that that whole infatuation thing, for some people like myself, I'll just say I come from a divorced home, and of course a lot of people from divorced homes tend to try to find the love they didn't get from their parents in boyfriend-girlfriend relationships and eventually marriage. And that whole infatuation thing, like Nancy was saying about it being it giving us information about our vulnerabilities and stuff, I seriously believe that just like anything that God created for us in this world, Satan can twist it and use it, and it becomes a chink in our armor. And it's definitely something to pay attention to if we keep getting infatuated for people who are, at least to our minds, wrong for us, or just unavailable or whatnot. So I just wanted to bring that to light.
Oh, okay. That's probably part of what you meant, Nancy, is watching who I become infatuated with. Maybe that says something about... Good point. Yeah. Okay.
I just had another quick thought, too. If you continue on in a marriage relationship trying to foster this thing, doesn't it seem to take a lot of energy? Self-absorption in that relationship, so that the two people that you're dealing with in this marriage, it reminds me of a couple, for instance, that uses alcohol all the time or uses drugs. In my line of work, I see that all the time. And they don't have no room for anything else. They tend to lose their children if they've had children, if there's any room for children at all. They have no space to give anything greater than themselves, because they're self-involved with this sense of this euphoria, this addiction to a drug, in a sense, an emotional drug. I was just wondering if that's one reason it goes away, because we need to, as a couple, start giving out.
Right. That's an excellent point. I've seen couples where they put a lot of energy into romancing one another, and it's almost always to the cost of their children or other relationships. And I think you're right. I mean, I think that's where it can become abusive, even within a marriage relationship, because I'm focused on having this feeling, this experience toward my spouse, but I have responsibilities, I have duties to attend to, and those are not important enough. Those are not as important to me. That those get moved to the periphery, and I focus on romancing my wife or husband. And I have to say, from my perspective, I think that's wrong. And the flip side of that is, one good reason why the romance doesn't have any room to grow within marriage is, it's tiring to raise children. I mean, you just get worn out. You don't have time to light the candles and do the stuff that makes for romance. Well, which are we supposed to do? What did God want us to do? To be servants to our children, or to be in love with one another, to gaze into one another's eyes and take one another in and be happy with one another? I think it's the servant thing. I think that's the gig God wanted us to do.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I also wonder if then at the end of that process, or in the middle of that process, when the romance goes away, you also feel that sense of emptiness sometimes, that you finally realize that other person isn't going to be able to give you everything that you had in that sense of addiction, had wanted. You said a couple weeks ago it was like you realizing that that's only going to be, I thought you did somewhere, will be satisfied. It's God's way of saying, I am the only fulfillment, truly, right. Not this self-centered relationship. And it seems that
this infatuation could, in fact, keep you from discovering that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, excellent point.
I think an important point is what you started off your talk with. I don't know of anybody who is infatuated with their with another person once they know them extremely well. Mm-hmm. The infatuation is only there when, as you refer to mystery, I would refer to it as there's a certain amount of ignorance. There's everybody's on their best behavior. You will only occasionally see somebody get upset. It's easy to love somebody that way and to feel excited and euphoric and all that. But when you have somebody mad at you frequently, or you're mad at them, or you're seeing them when they're dog tired and they're cranky, and that takes the euphoria out of it really fast. And I think the danger, probably the biggest danger I see with desiring that in quote-unquote Christian marriage is that it's by striving for that all the time, you're going to be constantly failing, and we think something's wrong with us then when we fail and we don't attain that, and so we think something's wrong with our marriage, and it just starts to deteriorate the whole marriage. Both people in the relationship think something's wrong with them and that it shouldn't be like this. Well, in fact, it should be like this. You need to work through those difficult times. Mm-hmm. Not always seek for something ecstatic.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah, there's an implication of what you're saying as well, is that part of romancing is to become someone I'm not, to put on a persona. And that's antithetical to what I think marriage should be all about.
Yeah. It has to do with what Terry said and the gentleman over on the left about the nobility of the behavior when you're enthralled in Eros. And thinking back, it was so long ago, how I found myself doing all the things that a righteous person would do. And yes, it was an unrealistic behavior pattern, but a super righteous person would do. I mean, I've never seen myself do it again since, about the sacrifice part, yeah. Things like that. The, you know, staying up till 4 in the morning for whatever reason. But I think that the bait is to see these qualities in your behavior that are actually really noble, and when they fade, you feel less noble as a Christian because you're not as sacrificing as you once were. Kind of piggybacking on what Terry said. Mm-hmm. Now, the gentleman on the left side of the room said something about is that reality a product of a broken world, or is that reality just reality in the reality of a good world? Meaning,
he's not a gentleman.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that was it. That was pretty much it about how. Is this?
You mean you want me to say more to persuade you that it's one rather than the other, or?
Well, I think that before he asked the question, you said it's nice and romance is great, but it's also pursuing this is unrealistic. It's an unrealistic view. Now, that part about being unrealistic is reality. The reality of the mundane in the post-Eros relationship, is that sanctification? It seems to me that you're saying that's sanctification because you're living within a true and real world as opposed to a drug-induced world that may be temporal.
Right.
Even though the behavior in that drug-induced world is on the outside, and if you were to evaluate it, incredibly noble and righteous.
Right, right. But let's analyze that behavior morally. Why am I doing it? For pretty selfish reasons. I mean, I don't know that there's really anything fundamentally good about the behavior, because it gives me incredible pleasure to serve when I'm under the throes of Eros. I'm doing it for the pleasure of it, not for the goodness and the rightness of it. I mean, at least as much for the pleasure of it as I am for the goodness and rightness of it. So in terms of real goodness and real morality, I don't think it's happening there. You see what I'm saying? Yeah, it's drug-induced. I'm behaving better than I am because I'm out of my mind.
I have a question.
Okay.
I guess I'm a relative newlywed. And I wanted to ask, you mentioned something last week when you were talking about sexuality and pleasure in sexuality, and how sexuality in marriage isn't necessarily meant for pleasure. I mean, we're not to seek out after that, but serendipitously, it can happen. And I was wondering if you would draw an analogy to kind of that feeling of Eros in marriage.
Yeah, exactly.
That it could, you know, I might not have butterflies every time I see my husband now, but there might be a moment where it happens. And if that happens, that's a wonderful thing, but I shouldn't work for that.
Yeah, I would. But I also think there's a qualitative difference, too. I mean, an emotional response is an emotional response, but Eros is an emotional response that largely is without substance or has imaginary substance to it. After experience with the other person and getting to know them and knowing them, you can have what we might call butterflies in our stomach, but I think it's different. I don't think it's the same. I think there's more substance to it now, because it's rooted in experience, common and shared life, a genuine affection for a person who really is there and really is that person. And so I hesitate to even call them the same phenomenon, because I think they're qualitatively different.
Well,
they're both emotional
better.
Responses. But,
sounds better.
Okay.
I think I would call the feeling that replaces the Eros through experience in life a richer relationship,
right,
where life is tough and you've got this person who knows you and he still loves you and is committed to you, and I mean, that's pretty rich. And then going through stuff together and that bonding, that that just life is tough, and having a partner through life, I think, replaces that Eros in a deeper, richer sense, where you're no longer trying to create that. Because I remember mourning the first. I called them the first. You know, the first time you'd hold hands. Or, you know, just, you have to get past that. And it was a sense of loss, but then time brings a richer relationship that can't be with anyone else.
Yeah, well said. That's exactly how I look at it.
I can well understand the negative aspects of trying to imaginatively continue Eros or trying desperately to seek after that pleasure, but I'm having a hard time seeing why we shouldn't just categorize Eros as a negative and whenever it happens, you know,
run from it.
You know, whip ourselves or whatever. bad. But, I mean, aside from some evanescent pleasure, what are the benefits of it?
Good point. No. What I'm arguing is that, well, okay, two things. In a sense, what you're saying, there is some validity to what you're saying. I mean, there's a sense in which, yes, we should put it in its place and not pursue it and not credit it too highly. On the other hand, it's very, very compelling. And so even though, yeah, that would be the right thing to do, we're going to be affected by it. I mean, maybe some people more than others, but it's likely to be a very, very compelling feeling that has a huge impact on my life. Now, what I've argued is the impact can be a good impact, and I think I'm arguing that that's what God designed it to do, the role that he designed it to play, is to take me, who otherwise would be scared to death to enter into a relationship with a woman and committing my life to them, and actually giving me a vision for that committed relationship for life as being a good thing. That this has expanded my consciousness and started me thinking about the joy and the delight and the pleasure that a marriage commitment could be. And in a way that in a more ordinary emotional state, I may not even be open to asking myself the questions that would let me come to that conclusion. So I think it can open me up to the possibility of marriage where I would otherwise be closed to it. That's what I'm arguing is it's, I think, intended effect and a positive effect of it.
So God gives us this drug and induces us to make this commitment, and a few weeks later we wake up and we go, well, this doesn't feel anything like it did then.
Right.
Is that a dirty trick, or is it pointing to something, you know, in the future that's going to come to fruition?
Well, the reason it seems like a dirty trick is because our mythology has put so much emphasis on love and has made it the staple and the foundation for a marriage. I think in a culture that didn't do that, it wouldn't be so mind warping. It wouldn't be quite so jarring to us. I suppose it's a little bit like throwing your kid in the deep end of the swimming pool. I mean, okay, swim.
You're gonna like it. You're gonna like it once you get the hang of it.
Exactly. Yeah. So in that sense, yeah, probably a bit of a dirty trick in that sense. But that's how and when we grow up, we're faced with some important and tough choices about what is my life all about, what am I all about, what am I to do now. I've seen some. I don't know if they're real or not. But I've been pretty close to some relationships where one of the people in the marriage, for whatever reason, and you have to wonder why, and so you don't know everything about the history and so on, but one of the people in the marriage was just mean and the other person just loved back. Well, it's not exactly Hollywood or Disney, but I was always very impressed by that. That there was a person there who was keeping their part of the bargain, who was keeping their commitment before God, even if the other person wasn't. And it always struck me as very noble and very right and very good and very healthy. I'm not sure why I'm saying that. Somehow it related to what you're asking.
It
only seems like a dirty trick when we think, going way back to my very first lecture, when we think that the meaning of my life is marriage. You know, when that's my fulfillment, that's my happiness, that's what marriage is for, is to finally give me what I want to make me happy. But no, life is about sanctification. It's about wisdom. It's about learning to know and love God. And if it takes a hellish shrew of a wife or a real sarcastic bully of a husband in order for me to learn that, then okay. I mean, are we the kind of people that can stand before God and then say, so be it. This is the schoolhouse that you've given me, but the important thing is you haven't robbed me of wisdom. I have an opportunity here to know you, to know what it means to love you, to know what it means to obey you, to know what it means to honor you, God, and that's what this life is for anyway. But you don't have the delights and joys of other marriage. Yeah, that's right. And some people go through life blind and lame and deaf and have all kinds of things that they're deprived of. Life throws that at us. God has not promised us that we're not going to be deprived in this existence. And one of the things we might be deprived of is a really, truly happy marriage where the one I'm married to is my friend. I may be deprived of that. Okay. But it doesn't mean that I've been robbed of life itself. And so I can learn to go ahead and keep my commitment that I've made in that marriage anyway. Because it's not really about me, me being happy. It's not really about my happiness. It's about my integrity my character, my commitments to the things of God. So even if it's a dirty trick in that sense, it's still a fantastic opportunity that life gives me to do my life right.
It seems like it's only a dirty trick to those who are not using the opportunity that God has given them with this quote-unquote drug. If a person is feeling that sensation, they need to start asking some hard questions anyway and get to know the other person well. It's only the person who doesn't take that opportunity in that time who wakes up on the other side and thinks, oh my God, what did I do? You know,
Yeah. What
have I gotten myself into? If you take the opportunity, you have a longing and a feeling towards this person, it's a perfect time to get to know them and find out who they really are, and then you're using wisdom with it.
But as St. Engelbert Humperdinck said, I lost that love and feeling. Oh, the righteous brothers? Oh. Well, then they must have been right. Well, we'll pursue some more of this next quarter.